couple weeks ago, a local incubator for innovation and education held a summit, not on test scores or technology in the classroom or kindergarten readiness or any of the other hot button issues. The summit brought together big thinkers and leaders to discuss what's going on with school buses, particularly in Kansas City, Missouri. Their routes are inefficient. The buses themselves are gas guzzlers. They take time and money from the classroom. According to recent headlines, they sometimes get lost or leave kids stranded. And the real problems with the buses reflect larger divisions we have to reckon with in Kansas City, whether we have school-age kids in public school or not. So today on KCUR Central Standard, we'll hear more about what was discussed at the Lean Labs Summit on Reimagining Student Transportation, starting with CEO and founder Katie Booty, who organized the summit. Hi, Katie.
Hey, Gina. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So as I kind of hinted at, you're really into like big thinking, bold thinking. And to some people, looking at the bus system might not sound like this pressing question about education. What made you think that our approach to school transit was in fact in need of really thoughtful innovation?
Well, the story begins about 3 years ago. Every year we do an annual listening tour with all of our school system leaders, teachers, students, and our school community to hear what their vision for the future is. And we couldn't get out of a school building without a school leader or principal going on about a 20-minute tirade about how terrible student transportation is and that they didn't know where their students were or the bus was running late or it's so expensive and inefficient, et cetera, that we realized we can talk about, you know, all of these wonderful learning technologies till the cows come home, but until we can get kids efficiently and safely and reliably into the classroom day in and day out, it's for nothing. So we had to take a step back and realize what would it take to really reimagine our student transportation system within a 21st century context.
So describe the problems with the current bus system in Kansas City, Missouri, from your perspective.
Yes, many things. Well, the first thing I think that's important to note is that the state of transportation in general has changed drastically over the last even just 5 years. And school transportation, yellow buses, have not kept up with that. So if you think about Uber, Lyft, ride sharing, et cetera, our school transportation just hasn't experienced any of that innovation. Two, specific to Kansas City, we're unique in the sense that we're a very pro-school choice city. So what that means is that about almost half of our kids are, or more than half of our kids actually, are going to schools that are not their neighborhood schools. They're going to either signature schools within the district, like a Lincoln Prep, or they're going to a charter school. What that means is that those boundaries are citywide. So what that means is that kids are no longer taking short, efficient routes on the school bus to their neighborhood school down the street. They're ping-ponging all over the place. And each different school system has their own different and separate transportation vendor, which means that if you can imagine, school buses are literally passing each other every day to different schools.
And then that would also mean that if you're looking at like a block within the city, that you could have like several different school buses making stops on the same block.
Yeah,
on different routes.
Yeah, absolutely. What's really funny is I rode the bus on the first week of school with one of our partner schools just to see. We'd done some work with Academy for Integrated Arts and Genesis, two charter schools here locally, and I rode the early morning route. And what's really funny and sad is that you see kids in like four different uniforms on the corner of a street helping each other identify which bus is picking them up because they're all getting on separate buses to go to different schools.
That are all yellow.
That are all yellow. Yes.
How does the situation look different in Kansas City, Missouri than in, say, Shawnee Mission?
Yeah. So, again, it goes back to bus service providers. So Shawnee Mission is one large system where all students are going to neighborhood schools. There's no school choice. So they have, I believe they do, they don't own their bus system. They have one contractor, one centralized routing system, and all the kids go. For a large amount of students, I think Shawnee Mission is about 20,000 students. For Kansas City, Missouri, we have 35,000 students going to 22 different systems. So you imagine that's 22 different bus contracts and vendors for a relatively similar amount of students. So what that means is that 22 different transportation, coordinators, different routes, et cetera, so on and so forth. And that provides that what that creates is a wide variety of transportation experiences.
What is the problem with, other than just inefficiency, with having a lot of different contracts, a lot of different vendors, many different buses going the same route? I mean, how does that actually play out for the students who ride the bus?
Right. One unfortunate thing that we've realized is that it disincentivizes high-quality vendors from coming to our local city market, because when you have 22 different contracts for a similar size student population, the contracts are really small and they're really hard to service. So that means if you're a bus company that's trying to find the most efficient way to provide high quality service, there's really no incentive for them to come into the market unless they're a small provider, unless they just really want to. So that's been a real challenge for us, is finding people with the bandwidth that can truly service the unique challenges of our city.
And then what about the experience of kids riding the bus under those circumstances?
Yeah, I mean, we have stories. Obviously, you mentioned the headlines of kids being lost for hours. Almost all of our schools at the summit mentioned that students typically have a 2-hour ride time per day. So they try to keep it under an hour, but it's not unusual at all for many of our city students to be on the bus 50 minutes to school, 50 minutes or more back from school.
You know, I'm curious about how issues with the buses affect what happens in the classroom and just what happens in kids' lives holistically.
Yeah. Well, one thing that has been a challenge for us is just buses are chronically late, right? So it's not unusual for kids to be missing whole chunks of instruction. And buses are, as a former middle school teacher and administrator myself, buses are notorious for where behavior infractions happen.
Explain that.
So you have a bus driver that is one person who is on a 60-passenger bus who is in charge of getting the children to school, picking them up, and also making sure they're safe, and doesn't have eyes in the back of their heads. So they can't tell if, you know, Tommy is hitting Julie or so on and so forth. And kids are smart and know when they can get away with things. And that's typically when, you know, you see behaviors act up.
What kinds of ideas came up in the summit for addressing all of this? The range of issues you just described is pretty huge. Like, it's everything from the geography of the city to and the way the school systems relate to that, to discipline on the bus and everything in between, vendors.
Yeah, so I mean, it's a very complex problem. And so it's required a variety of solutions. So 3 years ago, like I mentioned, when we first began this conversation, what we realized was that the safety issue and the lack of transparency was a really big problem. Transparency meaning that administrators would be like, hey, the bus is 20 minutes late, but I have no insight into where it is, what's going on, what the estimated arrival time is, or what's happening inside that bus. So a few years ago, we incubated a technology called Transportance, which is a hardware-software solution. It has a little tablet that sits inside the bus that gives bus drivers step-by-step directions, as well as administrators, an Uber-like app that monitors the whole fleet. So they can see the entire bus fleet in real time where the bus is, and it sends a notification to parents and students about their estimated arrival time. It also provides high-definition cameras inside the bus so that with a click of a button, an administrator can see in real time what's happening. And here, it provides audio as well so that it solves that pain point of, there was a behavior infraction on the bus. I need to know what happened. I can tell with 21st century technology what actually happened in that instance, as well as be able to monitor where the bus is in real time.
And that takes the discipline issue off of the bus driver and puts it back in the school's hands.
Right. That's exactly right. And gives them some ability and some tools to be able to actually act on it. But we realized that wasn't enough, that it's a great tool that provides us a lot of visibility and data, but it doesn't solve the core inefficiencies of our Kansas City, Missouri system at large. So the second step then was to bring in Ashley Hand, who's also here.
And, yeah, we'll talk to her in a second.
In the office, and see what we could do system-wide. And we realized this vendor issue was a really huge problem. So we talked to more of our schools. We talked to more of our vendors. And what we realized was organically, four charter schools had banded together to share a vendor and begin experimenting with what collaborative transportation solutions could mean. So what that meant is that they jointly wrote an RFP. They kind of were more creative in that approach in terms of that they wrote in some language around holding school bus vendors accountable for time, like for routes arriving on time, for use of 21st century technology, et cetera. And then they went through the RFP process, selected a vendor, and then began sharing it. That collaborative alone saved the whole Kansas City public school system $467,000 last year. And on average, they began saving over $100,000 per school that they could reinvest back into the classroom. What that tipped off was we realized this is really interesting. This is a shared approach. Then what would be possible if we were able to scale up that shared approach across the system? If we could get more schools talking about sharing transportation service.
And what you just mentioned about the financial savings is not insignificant either, because the cost of transportation comes out of the school budgets, right?
Absolutely. And what we know, we also did a cost analysis. This is a $29 million problem just within Kansas City boundaries alone. And school transportation ranges between 6 and 10% of all schools' operating budgets. So it's not insignificant whatsoever. Transportation costs are also rising, while the state reimbursement for transportation continues to decrease or stagnate.
And so that's money that could be spent, what, on like overhead projectors or
everything. I mean, literally people. It's money that are, because school choice is such a reality in Kansas City, our administrators are making the hard choices of, do I literally get kids into the classroom, or can I hire another teacher, a counselor, build more interventions for students, all of those things.
I'm Gina Kaufman talking to the Lean Lab's Katie Booty about ideas for addressing problems with school buses in Kansas City, Missouri. If you have experience with any of this stuff we're talking about, as a parent, a student, a neighbor, a teacher, call 816-235-2888. We want your take. 816-235-2888. And now I want to bring in another guest on this. Ashley Hand is a parent. She was involved in starting Hale Cook, a neighborhood school in Waldo. She used to work in City Hall as the chief innovation officer, and she's recently started a consulting firm working with city governments all over the country. Ashley, you recently wrote an article about school transit for Medium. What was your argument?
The fact that mobility has changed in the 21st century, technology has enabled more on-demand, kind of the right sizing of transportation solutions to the need. So in order for us to really innovate the school bus, we have to think about it as a system of systems, and getting away from the idea that it's the household or the school that has to solve the problem, but that there's perhaps a third solution, which is the community-based solution.
When you say system of systems, what do you mean?
Well, the fact is that we can't assume that there's going to be a one-size-fits-all solution for every neighborhood, for every school, for every child. So it's really important to have a variety of options and choices in those solutions that work well together to the greater benefit and the outcome of improved efficiency.
It sounds so simple. Kid needs to go to school, the bus comes and gets them. Like, that doesn't sound like a system of systems kind of thing, but the Kansas City context really does make it pretty complicated.
Absolutely. I think as a transportation problem, it's perhaps one of the simplest to resolve. You know the origin, where their destination, where they're going, what time they need to be there, what time they need to be picked up. But the challenge, as Katie was mentioning, of having a city block where you have 5-6 schools represented, there's incredible inefficiencies in kind of this individualized approach. So at this point, it's really about a system of schools working together, and this collaborative purchasing effort that was done by the First Transportation Collaborative is really kind of a major first step forward.
Can you talk about where you're coming from personally on all of this as a parent?
Well, as a parent, you know, I have the privilege of using public transit right now to get my kids to and from school. But I also feel very disconnected from people who live in the neighborhood that attend the same school. So how do I have redundancy in case something goes wrong? I work and I travel. So there's possibilities that my schedule is interrupted and it may be difficult for me to get my kids in time from school. How can I turn to a neighbor when I don't even know where they are and not sure that they can actually help me? Being able to use technology in the era of the sharing economy, where that information is much more readily accessible, we can opt in to sharing that data with each other. Now I'm starting to create a safety net within my own neighborhood, which is great for me not only as a parent, but it's great for my children as well, because then they get to know who else lives in the neighborhood that goes to their school, but also what the benefit of having a sense of community really is.
So it's interesting to me that your choice about how to navigate all of this has been to use the public transportation system as opposed to the school's transportation system. And then that when you feel left in a lurch based on the fact that you're doing that as an individual household as opposed to as part of a school community, that the lurch you're left in is really that you don't have the safety net or sense of community. But that for that, you're turning to a vision of a sharing economy, something like an Uber or Lyft type thing for kids, as opposed to a school bus.
Well, I think the school bus still will work for certain types of trips. And I think that's really important. And what we're seeing in mobility as a whole in the cities across the country through this digital revolution is that it's public transit complemented by micromobility and other services that are smaller scale and more flexible for different types of trips. So recognizing that the yellow school bus will probably remain very important. But looking at what the KCATA has done recently with handing out school passes, transit passes to high school students for free, they are not allowed by state law to use those transit passes to get to and from school. And when we did a mapping to look at the type of overlap between public transit routes and where students lived and where they were headed in terms of which schools they were attending, we saw that there was a huge opportunity to alleviate the burden on yellow school buses to provide all of that transportation, because now they have access to a fairly efficient and very reliable transit system through the KCATA.
Why aren't they allowed to use those passes to go to school?
You know, this is one of those things that we see quite a bit in terms of technology revolutions, is that our policies and processes have not quite caught up. So the definition of what qualifies for school transportation is fairly rigid and based on a 20th century model. What we see as an opportunity, and through the work that's been happening here in Kansas City, is an opportunity to redefine what qualifies as school transportation. You know, in addition to public transportation, if you could imagine a carpooling service where parents would potentially be reimbursed for their mileage, for the time that and distance that they travel with the children, you could then create a carpooling model that's actually an incentive for parents to participate because they get reimbursed for their mileage, but it's enabled through that technology. Our policies and processes do not enable that currently.
When you think about, I mean, you've referred to a digital revolution and a transportation revolution. What are you talking about? And is this something that you're seeing more in other cities?
Absolutely. So if you think about the proliferation of the smartphone, that is the fastest adopted consumer product that we've seen in our lifetime. And it has really functionally transformed our expectation of on-demand services, but also in quality of services. This idea of being user-centered becomes really important. We need to design a school transportation system that serves our student needs first, instead of the inconveniences of an inefficient system. So if you think about bell times, for example, schools are jockeying about what time they will start school because of the availability of school buses, not because of what it does for educational outcomes, for the impact on families, or the welfare of the children, really. I mean, so when you think about somebody having to get on the bus at, you know, 6 a.m. and then having to go to school and have their head on straight to be able to get everything they can out of the classroom, that's an awful lot that we're putting, and we have to recenter the conversation around how do we solve for student needs first.
You know, looking at this from the city level, and the policy level, it's also hard to separate the root of the problem from the issues we face as a city and in the culture around urban public education on the whole. Can you speak to that?
Absolutely. You know, I think we have a few challenges here. Land use decisions and access to transportation are a big issue in the city at large. So I think this is a microcosm and reflecting that quite effectively. And the fact that we do have a lot of school choice creates a lot of opportunity. But students are disconnected from their schools if they have to live far away and don't have easy transportation access. When we were working on Hale Cook years ago, we found a study that showed that people's participation in after school activities, including by families, drops off significantly with every mile distance to school.
Which makes sense, because that's just time that's being used on transportation that is no longer available.
Exactly. And so what we see as a huge opportunity is to leverage shared services between schools as an opportunity to not only build community within neighborhoods, but also to improve the outcome. Getting kids to school more effectively through better service will ensure that they kind of minimize some of those behavioral issues, and we're certainly creating a better opportunity for them to learn.
Your family lived in LA for a while, mm-hmm. and I'm curious about what sort of like comparative framework you have for looking at this based on that experience as compared to living here.
So while I was in Los Angeles, I worked on a transportation strategy for the city of LA. So while I was taking my children from my neighborhood to downtown where they went to preschool, we would ride transit. And the experience of sitting with my children and focusing on the journey and not on the intensity of driving ourselves and watching them interact with the community of people that were interacting with them on the bus, whether it was a bus driver or other riders, helped me kind of come up with a concept called transportation happiness. And this idea that our user experience is really fundamental to the type of choices that we have. If we can create a school bus environment or the transportation environment that says, welcome to school, welcome to your learning environment, and it's the kind of the first touch of our school systems, I think we'll see that children will respond in kind. And I think that's something that we saw living in Los Angeles, relying on moving together with our children instead of, you know, getting stuck in a car.
So then professionally, as someone who has worked in City Hall in Kansas City and as someone who works on pushing for policy level change with cities all over the country, I am also wondering what you understand about the challenges that are going to arise in making the kinds of changes you're talking about a reality, and understanding from the inside of how all of these things work that others may not have.
Sure. So definitely there's some challenges in advancing state legislation, making it a priority to rethink the school bus at the state level to create some room for innovation is really essential. Having aggregators at the local level, being able to help us coordinate and create the function of how do we work together across different school systems and different funding mechanisms becomes really important. KCPS, for example, and their recent transportation contract has allowed for a rider to allow for charters to collectively purchase on and be part of that contract in the future once they get through their first year of stand-up. So I think there's a lot of opportunity to think about who will serve in that function of bringing people together to share data to ensure that when there is a joint solicitation for contracts, that they're working together and kind of coming to terms and agreeing on, you know, we'll move our start times, we agree to the same behavior rules, we're going to have the same policies around certain things to make it easier to work together.
And Katie, what is it that you might be able to help us understand about the challenges in getting some of these things done from the educator's standpoint, from the school standpoint, that the typical listener, typical parent maybe doesn't get?
I think that it requires a lot of coordination, one, and also it requires a mindset shift. You know, we really have been working closely with a lot of educators, transportation directors, school administrators to begin just being able to conceptualize what is outside of the yellow school bus, like what other options are even there.
People feel very nostalgic about the yellow school bus. I even feel nostalgic about it, and I never rode one.
Yeah, people feel less nostalgic about it when they are dealing with the day-to-day reality.
Maybe when they did ride one.
How expensive it is. But it is, I think, to Ashley's point, we live in a paradigm where most of school transportation has been dictated by what service providers could provide versus what's actually best for children.
I'm Gina Kaufman. We're talking about problems with school transit in 2019 in Kansas City. We'll hear your perspectives in a minute. Call 816-235-2888. When you call, you'll get to speak with a bus driver, too. He will be joining us when we return. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we are talking about the school bus system, which appears to be siphoning resources from classrooms, polluting the environment, taking up precious student time, crisscrossing the city due to a fractured public school landscape. At least that's what we've been hearing about Kansas City, Missouri, and actually other cities where charter schools are big, meaning that kids living on the same block don't necessarily go to the same school. My guests are Ashley Hand, who consults on innovation, and Katie Booty, who runs an education think tank called Lean Lab. Hi again, you two.
Hello.
I want to bring in another voice now, a bus driver. He drives a bus in Olathe, not Kansas City, but he also trains other bus drivers, so he might have some perspective on all of this that those of us looking in from the outside just don't have. Errol Sharp, good morning.
Good morning.
How do you see the role of the bus driver in all of this? What is a bus driver sometimes up against?
Well, the bus driver role, I think, is pretty much very much important. We're pretty much responsible for transporting students to and from school daily. In most cases, we're almost like a mom and dad to the kids on the buses because kids do fun stuff. So,
well, do you hear about crazy zigzagging routes and what sound like, in some cases, nearly empty buses from any drivers you've trained or as something that like requires consideration?
Well, zigzagging routes, if you're, when you say zigzagging route, I'm not sure if you're referring to school buses getting lost or whatever. You know, we have cases where we have new drivers coming on board. They're not reading, might not be able to read the route correctly, or whatever. That could be part of the reasons why, you know, you're having this zigzag, so to speak. You got to understand that we have students that, say, for instance, you have one student living next to each other. They may have a specific school that they may need to go to. Like back in the days, we had vocational schools. I had to be transported, 5-10 miles out of my area to go to a particular vocational school where in my regular school, which I would have been attending, was about 4 or 5 miles, you know, less closer to my home. So that could be very well the case where you may have chartered students that may end up having to go somewhere else other than where that's within their zone.
We've been hearing about innovation, and I wonder if in your years of driving buses and training drivers, if you've wanted new innovations, like things to change about the bus itself or various tools or technologies, options?
Well, I know that they've had talks about GPS system installed on the buses, so things that can be located on stops much easier. And there's also been cases, things where there are equipments that are available, not currently in our location, but where it tracks each student. You know, so basically the student it flags the student or tags the student once they get on the bus and identify that they're on the correct bus. So the school or whoever's tapped into that system, they're pretty much aware of where that student is at any point at any time.
Are you glad to hear that people are talking, like that the general public is talking about the role of buses and transit and education? We hear so much about school and home, parents and teachers, but buses and bus drivers often get left out of that discussion.
Well, it seems like you hear most of the negative, to the truth, is what you hear. I think the negative is because of people are not aware of what it takes to be a bus driver and what we have to go through. It's a small environment, meaning the interior of the bus. We have 15 to 50 students on the bus at any given time, and things happen. Kids tend to act up. They're around their friends. They think they're on the playground. They think they're wherever, and they've got to understand it's not safe.
And you've got to keep driving.
Exactly. So we're constantly looking in that mirror and watching everyone, make sure that nothing crazy is going on in the back there.
What do you think does work about the school bus that maybe we haven't acknowledged or understood?
For one thing, I like, especially being here in Kansas, we have a good thing going on between the school, the parents, and the school bus company. So whereas
in Olathe, you do.
In Olathe, exactly. So whereas if there's an issue, if the parent has an issue, there's something that goes on, they contact the school and the school contacts us. There's that communication that's going on, which is one of the things I appreciate. That's one of the things that really stood out when I first started working here.
You used to work in Florida. Was that by contrast with another setup that you had done?
Another setup, different setup, different company.
So it seems like the particular arrangements between the schools and the contractors and the districts and all of the politics around that really do matter on a very intimate level mm-hmm. once there's a driver driving the bus and the kids riding the bus.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that's Absolutely right.
Let's talk to some of our callers now. You can join this conversation with your stories and perspectives on school buses, what works about them, what doesn't, and how it reflects Kansas City, Missouri in particular. We're going to be joined by Ryan, who's called 816-235-2888. Hi, Ryan.
Hi.
What do you want to share?
Well, I was just listening to the talk about buses, and I had also listened last week, and you had someone on with KC, Ride KC, and I think they were talking about micro transportation where they had vans just come around and pick people up as transportation, and I believe they said it cost like $1 one way. And I was wondering, would the KC school district be able to partner with Ride KC and implement that into transportation for kids to schools?
So I think, thank you, Ryan. It sounds like Ryan is referring to, we've heard about this on a couple of different shows, one of them being our portrait session with Robbie Mackinnon of the KCATA, but he was talking, at least on that conversation, about the gaps in routes and places that just aren't served, and that you can fill those with smaller vehicles kind of on more of an on-demand type situation.
Right, exactly. It's called microtransit. And I think one of the opportunities, I think the challenge for KCATA, they cannot replace school transportation. That's just not in their mandate. It's not in their charter. Again, it's where policies are actually restricting opportunity. There are cities across the country where students ride public transit all the time to get to and from school, so it's not inconceivable that we could get to the point, but making it the responsibility, the mandate of KCATA, Ride KC, to provide transportation for schools is not possible. However, the model of microtransit is a great example. It's a smaller scale vehicle. It's more on demand. It could be customized to, you know, students missing their a day because of illness or something like that. They may not make a route stop because it can be dynamically routed. And the city of New York City has just recently announced a partnership with VIA, which is a ride hailing company that has the same model, and to test how their solution for routing can help improve moving the more than 9,000 school routes to greater efficiency.
This question of whose responsibility it ultimately is to get kids to school is an interesting one. Katie, can you talk to me about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth noting that schools, especially charter schools, do not have to provide transportation. In fact, we have several that opt out altogether and put that responsibility back on the family. Now, when it gets to issues of equity and efficiency and the realities of our school choice market, where also many schools are competing for children, providing transportation becomes more and more attractive. So I think it's something that's up for debate. And when we're in a landscape where kids are choosing to go to schools and families are choosing to go to schools all across the city, no longer are they able to just walk their kid down the block to the neighborhood school, it is a big question of whose responsibility then is it? But again, our policies haven't necessarily evolved at the same rate.
Ashley, this is getting back to some of your initial motivation to establish Hail Cook, which was at the time that you started it, a closed building that had been a former neighborhood school, and then saying, you know, there's this whole community here and there's a building right here. Why don't we make a school? But it isn't following this model of people all over the metro use it. It's within certain parameters.
Right. And I think we see still in that neighborhood, it is a neighborhood school. It was mothballed. There was no plan to reopen it. And I think there is still an element of choice where students are picking to go to different signature schools or charter schools within that neighborhood. But we have less than 15% of students walking or biking to school in this country. That is a public health opportunity to start to bring back more active transportation. So when you can introduce alternative modes and make it safe on our streets for people to use active transportation to get to and from school, I think it creates a greater environment for parents in terms of having better choices for their students.
Part of what we've talked about is the bus itself. And I hear that there are some innovations that people want to see with the vehicle itself. Can you guys talk to me about those?
Yeah, I think one really exciting outcome from the summit was this decision to say, hey, we know there are all these policy constraints within the actual school day itself. We have legislative policy mandating the yellow school bus. We have transportation, budget line items, et cetera. However, the after-school place is a really interesting area to innovate in. So several schools raised their hand and said, hey, what would it mean if we started piloting out-of-school, after-school solutions that were outside of the yellow bus? That's where we can start piloting with things like microtransit provided by KCATA or other rideshare options or other carpooling and community options and see what does it mean to help kids get to their after-school activities in more safe, reliable, potentially active ways.
Errol Sharp, as a bus driver, is there anything that you want us to remember in all of the daydreaming about a newer, better system, about what the system is and has been?
Well, just a reminder that, you know, the number one thing is the student safety. Okay, that's one of the main things that's my concern. Our concern as bus drivers is student safety and getting them to and fro wherever they have to be. That's the number one thing that we're looking at. Right now, school buses have been proven to be one of the safest things possible there. You don't have as many issues or possibilities of what can happen and so forth because, you know, the drivers are well-trained. Mm-hmm. And so some of the things that you can imagine, they're not there. So we try to eliminate all of that.
Which is fascinating because school buses still don't have seat belts, do they?
You do have some that do and some don't. It's just a matter of the company, whatever companies require. Now, go ahead.
Oh, I was just wondering from Katie Booty, you know, what do you see as the biggest things we need to deal with as a city to make any positive changes a reality?
No, that's a big question. I think we need to come, and it's beginning to happen. All the relevant actors in this space, all the different transportation directors and administrators, and we're close, need to come together and say, what will it take to actually begin positing collective solutions and take collective action so that we can attract higher quality vendors and more interesting solutions to Kansas City?
Well, thanks so much to everyone. Katie Booty has joined us from the Lean Lab. Ashley Hand is here from CityFi. And Errol Sharp is a bus driver in Olathe and a bus driver trainer all over the metro. Thank you all so much. I'm Gina Kaufman. Next up on Central Standard, the author of not one, but two scary books set in Kansas. Stay tuned. Violet is a new novel by Scott Thomas. It's a thriller set in Kansas that's been dubbed Midwestern Gothic by a book critic for NPR, and that review caught our attention. What is Midwestern Gothic, and why is this guy writing it? I'm Gina Kaufman, and now we've got Scott Thomas, author of Kill Creek and now Violet, both set in Kansas, with us to discuss. Hi, Scott.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. I have only just started reading your new book, and I scare easily, so take this for what it's worth, but it's really creepy.
Oh, thank you.
Your pacing is... And again, don't take this the wrong way. It is slow and stagnant, but you make that very eerie. Like, there's something about nothing really happening, if you do it right, that can be very suspenseful.
Yeah, that was definitely the intent. Especially with Violet, because it's really at heart a ghost story. Once you sort of let that ghost out, then you have to deal with it. The characters have to deal with it. And so with Violet, I wanted it to be a slow burn. I wanted it to be sort of creepy and kind of this, you know, tightening fist around you that, you know, it's too late when you realize you can't get out of its clutches. So it is a slow burn, but I
on
like
purpose.
It is on purpose, yes.
Since you are probably... quite practiced at giving a plot summary that doesn't give anything away, I'm going to let you tell our listeners what Violet is actually about.
Okay. Violet is about a woman named Chris. When she was 10 years old, her mother was dying of cancer, and she and her father, her parents had a lake house in their family in sort of southern southeast Kansas. And instead of spending her last few weeks, the mother's last few weeks in a hospital, her dad said, well, let's go to this lake house and we'll have, you know, some sort of family time with your mom as she's getting sicker. But Chris was 10 years old. It was very difficult for her. She was very lonely and very sad. So she made up a friend named Violet to play with that summer. And then her mother died and she and her father left the lake house and never went back. Now Chris is 41 years old. She has a daughter of her own named Sadie, who's 8 years old. They live in Colorado and they experienced their own tragedy. Chris's husband is killed in a car accident. And so, you know, she remembers this lake house that they still have in their family. And she says, well, let's get out of town. Let's go to this lake house and sort of have a summer to heal. Unfortunately, when they get there, the lake house is not as she remembered it. It's sort of dilapidated now. And also, Sadie begins to spend more and more time alone playing upstairs by herself. And eventually, Chris realizes she's playing with an imaginary friend named Violet. So Violet may or may not have been in this home by herself for the last 30 years waiting
abandoned.
For Chris to return. Yes.
So this book, like your first, as we've mentioned, is set in Kansas. What draws you to this particular setting for horror? Because the first book was not quite horror itself, but more a commentary on horror. A hard word to say, by the way.
Yeah, it Kill Creek was my first novel, and it is a horror novel, but it is sort of meta. It is about four horror authors who spend the night in a haunted house in the Kansas countryside. And so because of that, it was gave me the opportunity to comment on horror, because I love horror. It's always been my favorite genre since I was a little kid.
Why?
I don't know. I just was always drawn to scary stories, to sort of campfire stories.
For what it's worth, you don't seem like a creepy guy.
Oh, thank you. I guess I hide it well. But I just really like that. If you look back at photos of all of my birthday cakes growing up, they had ghosts on them. They had haunted houses on them. That's what I wanted. And my birthday is like 3 days before Christmas, so it wasn't like even like I was in October. It was not the time
it
for haunted house cakes. No, but I just always enjoyed it. And when I was in the first grade, I wrote a little story, one page on the back of a picture I'd drawn, and it was about a detective who finds a headless body floating next to a cruise ship, and people, instead of being alarmed, they encouraged me. And so I kept writing. Yeah, it was. And so I just kept writing scary stories. I think the thing that draws me back to Kansas, because I grew up in Kansas. I grew up in Coffeyville.
And you live in L.A. now.
I live in L.A. I've been in L.A. for about 21 years. But I grew up in Coffeyville, which is a small town in southeast Kansas. Went to KU. And then once I graduated from KU, I moved to L.A. To pursue a career in film and television. But when I decided to write a book, and I knew it was going to be a ghost story, it was going to be a supernatural story, there was something about Kansas that just felt right. There's something about being sort of in the natural world that you don't get when you're in the middle of L.A., you know, when you're in a big city like that, it's easy to be consumed with your job and your life and your family, and you don't really have a moment to kind of remember that that there's sort of something bigger than you. And when you're in Kansas, you know, I growing up, especially when a thunderstorm would roll in and those clouds are green and they're flying by so low it looks like you can touch them, and the tornado sirens start to go off, you very quickly know that you are not in control, that there's something bigger at work here. And so setting these stories in rural areas, in the sort of countryside where nature is very alive, and that sort of power that you feel when you go out walking in the woods, or you know,
power of something else,
of something
not yourself.
Else. Yes, that there's just something else there. And of course, unfortunately, my mind tends to go to the dark places. So instead of uplifting hopeful stories about that power, I tend to write dark, twisted stories.
The other thing that I think about is that the story in Violet is so much about memory and loss. And if you think about the prairie landscape, which is like
grass for miles and miles, and then maybe there's one tree and you have some like horrible memory related to that tree. You really can't ignore it. There's not like a huge distraction from it. You can't never see that tree again. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think there is something, and especially with Kill Creek is set in a basically, I would see when I went to KU, I would drive between Lawrence and Kansas City, and I would always see that exit for Kill Creek Road. And I never took it, but it always stuck in my head. And I knew that would be a really fun title for a novel at some point. So I made up where that road went. And in the book, it leads to an old house called the Finch House, which is supposedly haunted and has a long history of scary things happening there, and now is abandoned. In Violet, it's Chris's family's lake house that is sort of the abandoned house, the abandoned property that where, you know, these awful things are going to happen. And there's just something about when you're right, when you're in the country or you drive by an old house and you know, clearly someone lived there at some point. Things happened there, but now the windows are all broken out and it's you know, the roof is caving in. And you start to wonder what happened there. That house is full of memories for someone, you know, they could be good, they could be bad, but now it's kind of been forgotten. But it's still there. It still exists.
So what is Midwestern Gothic in your mind? What does it mean? And why do you think it strikes a chord with your readers no matter where they live? Because it's not just Kansans reading your book.
No. It's funny because Midwestern Gothic really hasn't been written about that much. To me, the Gothic in general, if you think about it, it's very regional. It's very localized. If you think of English, sort of British Gothic, it's crumbling castles and manors. If you think about Southern Gothic, it's sort of dilapidated mansions. But the Midwest, we don't really have those structures. And they are sort of, all of those structures are echoes from the past. They're things that at one time sort of had moments of glory and now are forgotten and are crumbling. And what I sort of came to realize for myself was in the Midwest, we are very tied to the land. The land is sort of our structure in the Gothic. And then in Gothic stories, there's always a secret. There's kind of a dark secret. There's an original sin that is trying to be hidden away in these places. British Gothic, it's more, you think about like ruling class that sort of subjugated many of the people, you know, when there were kings and queens. When you think about Southern Gothic, obviously there's sort of the original sin of slavery and what those sort of plantation houses and mansions meant and what they still mean. And in the Midwest, there's the land, and that land ultimately was taken from Native Americans and acquired through the murder and forced relocation of Native Americans. But then when you think about, you know, my grandfather was a farmer. We as Midwesterners are very proud of our work ethic and of what we get from the land, what we make from the land. And so it's sort of that sense of we are tied to this thing, but then lately, as we're seeing, you know, a lot of people who are a lot of farmers, a lot of ranchers, you know, a lot of miners feel forgotten. They feel as if they are that sort of Gothic element that has been overlooked, has been cast aside.
So the person who works the land is the castle, is...
They are sort of the secret that is in the castle. And if you think about sort of where we are with, there is some truth to kind of the coastal elitists that look at us as flyover states.
So it's like just the fact of a character inhabiting this land is like, ooh, I'm still here.
Yes. And the land is, that's why Violet and Kill Creek are very tied to the land and the Midwest.
What do you hope readers get from Violet in the end, plot notwithstanding?
I hope that it is a meditation on grief. It's a very personal story. It's about a mother and a daughter. But ultimately, I hope that it scares them.
Our time is up. Scott Thomas, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Scott is the author of Violet. It's a novel. His first book was Kill Creek. They're both set in Kansas. You can listen back to our conversation at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. That's where you can get any of our past conversations and sign up to have them sent to you like a podcast. Do all of that at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, Homelessness in Lawrence. That show, that conversation, tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Noah Taborda, Ann Kniggendorf, Aviva Okeson-Haberman, and Sylvia Maria Gross. Sylvia is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.